Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.
What came next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Dr. Kelly Bowling and Dr. Danielle Slakoff join us today to discuss their impactful research about the creation and consumption of true crime media. They both bring years of experience and expertise to their work in hopes of inspiring true crime to be a more equitable, healing space for victims and co-victims. The Broken Cycle Media team has long admired their work and is honored they would join us to talk about their discoveries and how we can all work to improve the genre for those at the center of crime.
My name is Dr. Danielle Slakoff. I'm an associate professor of criminal justice at California State University, Sacramento, also called Sacramento State. I teach a lot of different things in the department, but generally I teach about media and crime, domestic violence, women's issues in the criminal justice system. And lately, I've been teaching a class on contemporary criminal justice issues. And I'm really lucky because I get to do research in those same areas. I've done predominantly research on media and crime, as well as domestic violence.
I am Dr. Kelly Bowling. I am an assistant professor at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln in the College of Journalism and Mass Communications. I am technically in the Ad PR faculty group, but I teach a large lecture titled Social Justice, Human Rights in the Media, which intersects nicely with my research. I am a critical cultural scholar, and so I tend to look at the lived reality of media audiences. So traditionally, women of color, victims of domestic violence, how these women are depicted in the media and how they see themselves in the media and make sense of that depiction. So because true crime focuses a lot on women victims, it is a natural intersection with my research.
I am just really grateful and excited to have you both here because you are a fount of inspiration in my own life, but also you're making changes for people like me and like the people that we interview on this show all the time. And I am so deeply grateful for the work that you do. And I actually refer to it all the time when I do interviews as well, because I feel like you're giving the survivors who have been speaking about this for so long, and it makes me tear up, but validity. I hate that we need that, but we need that backing of academia and of people like you making the difference and finding out the qualitative and quantitative information we need to back up what we're saying. So thank you for being a part of that mass change and this movement for better for all of us.
Thank you for everything you do to bring survivor stories forward. And the feeling is very mutual.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. I love that you both come from different worlds, if you will, but have found each other and created such important work together. How did the work come to fruition?
It's been several years that we've been working together now, which I'm very thankful for. What I remember is just being a huge fan of Dr. Bowling's work and recognizing that we have a lot of similar interests. I honestly cannot remember who reached out first, but we've never met in person, which is wild because we've been working together for so long. I believe that one of us reached out online and just introduced ourselves and said, hey, we have similar interests, let's talk. And since then, we've published a lot together and done what I think is really important work together. But I would love to hear Kelly's side because sometimes I'm just bad with my memory on these things.
Yeah, I remember that very clearly. It was most definitely Danielle that reached out to me. And it was on Twitter. That was back when it was Twitter and everybody was on it. I was a PhD student. I was working on my dissertation. And Danielle sent me the nicest message telling me how much my research meant to her. She found it very interesting and she would love to work together. And when you are in the throes of dissertating, there is nothing about your mental health that is stable. And to get that message at that time meant so much to me, more than I can ever put into words. And I remember my reply was something along the lines of, thank you so much. This means a lot. I would love to work with you, but I'm working on my dissertation. And we both laughed about that. And she was like, oh my gosh, I definitely thought you were already a professor. I was like, nope, I'm dissertating. And so it just sort of grew from there. And what I've learned from that is how important it is to tell other people when you read their research and it resonates with you. Because a lot of times as academics, it can feel very lonely. And it means so much to learn that somebody read your research article and liked it.
It's been several years working together now and hopefully several years to come. I feel like it's true. Exactly what Dr. Bowling just said is that when you like somebody's research, I've tried to make it my mission to tell them because it is important. And I joke that sometimes it feels like screaming into the void with research. That's why I'm so thankful to people like you, Amy, who are allowing us to talk about this work so publicly.
Dr. Slakoff, do you remember what that initial study or research was that really caught your eye?
Yes, Dr. Bowling does amazing research on podcasting and true crime podcasting in general. I'm not sure if it was one about true crime podcasts or if it was about people who engage with true crime, but it just was in this area that I was very much hoping to start doing work in. And then together, our first piece was about how grief shows up in true crime. We worked on that with my colleague, Dr. Iman Tadros as well. And in that process, recognized that for sure, Kelly and I have a lot of similar interests.
Do you want to touch a little bit on what you found in your research about true crime podcasting?
Sure. One of the first studies I published was about the true crime podcast audience, and I did a survey on a true crime forum on Reddit. It was a class project. I posted the survey as a PhD student. What I found was overwhelmingly the people in the audience also wanted to know why they were listening. I got an amazing response to that survey. It was almost 300 participants. In a survey where you're not paying participants, that's unheard of. Overwhelmingly, they identified as women. They would take the survey and then respond on Reddit and say, can you please share the results here when you finish the survey? Because I want to know why I'm listening to this stuff. And that's when I realized it was a little bit more than this simple form of entertainment that a lot of people put it in. The reason why people listen is very complicated. But that was my first study specifically on people who listen to true crime podcasts. And then I was a student at the University of South Carolina. At the time, there was a really popular true crime podcast called Undisclosed that was a spinoff of Serial. And it was run by three lawyers that were all working for the defense. And one of those lawyers was a professor who's actually the associate dean at the School of Law at South Carolina. And so I thought, I'm a student. He's an associate dean. Maybe he'll let me interview him. And so I did. It was a phenomenal interview, and he connected me with other true crime producers. And so things just sort of snowballed from there. I got very into working with the audience. I got very into working with producers. I just became really passionate about the topic. The true crime audience is very complex. It's mostly women. They want to protect themselves. They're trying to make sure they understand what they need to do in this case. And that comes from a really layered place. A lot of times as women, that's what we're taught at a very young age. You need to protect yourself. Carry a flashlight. Keep a baseball bat in your car. All of those types of things we're taught as women to fear. So the reasons people listen to true crime are all very, very complex. There are most definitely victims and co-victims in the audience. I've spoken to domestic violence survivors who specifically listen to true crime narratives that focus on domestic violence. And some of them told me that their therapist recommended they listen to true crime so they could better understand the why. One of my participants told me, I need to understand why my stepfather hurt those who he said he loved. So a lot of it is just learning more about their situation, but almost from a distance. What can I glean from that regarding how this could have happened to my family? A lot of the victims I spoke with also said our society silences them. Their stories aren't told, specifically women who are domestic violence survivors. Their stories are not told. They are told to be silent. When they do speak out, they're not believed. They told me that when they do share their story, the reaction they get from people is like, ooh, that's too heavy. That's too much. I want to be supportive, but I didn't really want to hear all of that. And so by listening to another story that's so similar to their own, they feel like they're not alone. These women start to think, this didn't happen to me because of me. This person in this true crime series is a doctor. She's smart, and this happened to her too. So a lot of times these women feel shame, silence, a complete and total lack of support from our society, even within their own families, and very, very isolated. And so listening to these other stories makes them realize, you know what, this is happening so often that this podcast is producing a new story every single week. I'm not alone here. So even though they may not know anybody else covered, any of those other victims or co-victims, they feel this sense of camaraderie. So it can be healing.
There's definitely a misconception that everyone is engaging because of this morbid curiosity or because they're interested in violence. I think for many people, as Dr. Bowling just said, but especially women, there is a sense of wanting to recognize those red flags and to understand systems that failed for a lot of victims.
Thank you so much. I call upon that information and that research often every time I'm sharing myself. Not all of us can speak up, and those of us who can, we build that community deeply by sharing. Knowing that we aren't alone is so, so powerful. And the knowledge, as you were saying, learning about signs, red flags, markers, safety plans, all of that. Awareness can become prevention. So thank you for all that you do and you highlight. I'd love if you discuss the two formative studies you guys have created together.
This first study that we conducted together that just recently came out. Interestingly, they came out, I think, about within a month of each other, which doesn't always happen because timelines are so different in the peer review process. But this first study that we did together, we were really interested in how victim and missing people's family members and loved ones were impacted by true crime, and specifically what they viewed as the positive or the benefits of true crime. Through our interviews with those 20 co-victims, we found three primary positive impacts. The first one was bringing attention to their loved one or other people's cases. Second, they talked about educating people about the criminal justice system and the issues with it. And then third, they said that true crime media can place pressure on criminal justice officials. And I want to be clear that even though this was a focus on the benefits of true crime, some of our respondents added really important caveats, essentially stating that the positive effects of true crime are really dependent on how the true crime is created, if it's ethical, if it's factual, and if it has co-victim consent. And I will say, out of this study, what surprised me the most was that third finding, this idea that co-victims felt true crime places pressure on law enforcement. To me, from the criminal justice side, that feels sort of like an indictment on law enforcement. Because what that tells me is that grieving loved ones or people who have a missing loved one, they feel like they have to use the media to force progress or to force updates. That finding, I think, really also speaks to how powerful the media is, because family members are saying this media pressure is making law enforcement move.
One of our participants said she wasn't getting any response back from her local law enforcement, but when she emailed them from a media address, they responded immediately. It's fear. This person has a tie to the media. So now I need to prioritize this email because me personally could be shown in the media in a negative light. So the media still feels very powerful. And in that case, that's fear from law enforcement, fear traditional media. But now that's gotten broader. Anybody can say a bad thing about you on TikTok or YouTube. So I think there's this inherent fear that the media brings, where people want to protect themselves from being part of negative publication. Sometimes that fear is motivating. Maybe it's also crippling, but I think a lot of it is that fear of self-protection.
I completely agree. I also feel, to the point about our participants who talked about the power of the media to impact law enforcement officials, that was some of the most powerful things that we heard, in my opinion, because I think on some level, and I'm coming at this from somebody who has a bachelor's degree in journalism and then switched to criminal justice. Throughout my life and in my work, I've always focused on this intersection, and I've been told media and crime is not a real research interest. Like, it's so niche, right? It's so minute. And I just don't think that's true. I think so much of what we know about crime and justice, about victims, is from the media. And there's research that shows this, that people who are not directly involved with the criminal justice system, they learn a lot about the criminal justice system from the media, whereas the people with direct experience learn from their direct experience. I think the media is tremendously powerful in telling us what issues to care about. I engage with the media a lot with my work, and I know there are lots of people who don't engage with the media at all. They may jump on their phone or stand in front of the TV for a few minutes. But what's fascinating is that even those people, the low consumption folks, they're still catching the most pressing or repetitive headlines. So I think for both high consumption and low consumption consumers, I think the day's biggest crime stories or the year's biggest crime stories can still break through to them. For me personally, I spend a lot of time thinking about which stories are breaking through. Is it related to survivor characteristics? Is it related to the perpetrator or something else? I do think from the criminology side that the media has so much power, especially when it comes to teaching people about crime and justice. And not to be cliche, but with that power comes huge responsibility, right? So I'm really, really proud of that first study.
That first study was amazing. And it's interesting because it was the same folks that we talked to for both studies. When we talked to these people, we asked them the good and the bad. Specifically on this side of it, which would be the more negative aspects of true crime, what we found is in this world where everything, it feels like, is governed by an algorithm, we're served ads by an algorithm, we're served shows we might like by an algorithm, music we might enjoy by an algorithm, that algorithm can actually take you into a side of true crime that maybe you didn't start out on. You may have even identified as a fan, but you didn't realize where you're watching it. And through the algorithm, you may actually have seen things that you never would have watched before that could skate on the verge of unethical or just blatantly unethical. But looking at that, the participatory audiences, the algorithms, the fandom, we saw how easily it is for the genre to succumb to capitalism and sensationalism. And the co-victims that we spoke to said one of the biggest issues is inaccuracies, that a lot of what is produced is just not correct. Blatant falsehoods. Nobody's accusing the producers of out and out lying, but the information that's out there isn't true in most of the cases, is what they were saying. There's just so much inaccuracy. It's hard to wade through it all. Also, the tragedy is sensationalized. We had one participant say it's very difficult when you're trying to sell laundry detergent in a 30-minute show to not sensationalize things. That's totally driven by capitalism. They also talked about a loss of privacy due to the media attention. And the interesting part there was many of our participants didn't distinguish between traditional media and true crime media when they talked about media attention. What we found out was actually that a lot of the issues with media actually began with traditional media right after the crime happens. You've got people driving by their house with a camera lens out the front window, people hiding in their bushes, stuff like that. A lot of this is traditional media, honestly, breaking the rules of the Society of Professional Journalism Code of Ethics. So when you've got traditional media breaking those rules, then they're not really setting a great example for true crime media, especially since many of those folks are not in the media industry and don't follow journalism ethics. Some of our co-victims also discussed trolls online in really horrific ways. And another big thing was this lack of control over editing and production. So even when a co-victim agrees to be part of a production and they spend time giving their interview information and everything that they know about the case, often what they wanted to talk about, like a new fund that they've opened the victim's name, the fact that they're still working to fund cold cases and things like that, a lot of those things get cut. And what goes in is the one time they cried in the interview or something completely taken out of context. And so this ability not to control the final narrative was a big issue, which fed into the sensationalism and the capitalism and just the general mistrust of the industry. As a media scholar, I went into this research thinking, okay, the only way to produce ethical true crime media is going to be with a trained journalist, someone following the SPJ Code of Ethics that's going to adhere to those standards. And overwhelmingly, the co-victim said, no, the only person that can produce ethical true crime is a victim or a co-victim because they've been on the other side of it. And that was surprising to me, but it makes complete sense that even with the most stringent ethical guidelines and somebody wanting to follow them to the letter, they still can't truly understand the lived experience of a victim or a co-victim.
I bring up a lot because I think it's just a perfect example of how things can be detrimental and damaging, even if it's innocuous. A recent program that I was on, I spent hours and then an extra day filming with them. And the first line of the whole episode is incorrect. They basically said my parents were high school sweethearts, which I've never said ever, and which is not true. That's an inaccuracy. It goes against a lot of the things I've shared in the media. It's such a simple sentence that was narrated at the top by somebody else. But if something like that can be harmful, then I can only imagine the gradient and the depth with which almost anything can be. And it just goes to show that a producer, sometimes even a victim advocate, can't anticipate that like a survivor can.
I will say, too, that in teaching about this issue, when I talk to students about inaccuracies in true crime, they are shocked because there's this idea of it's going to be accurate, especially when real journalists are involved. And I find that to be so fascinating that actually so many of the people we spoke to said that both traditional and true crime, there were inaccuracies. One of the quotes that will always stand out to me from that study is, how am I going to fix all the inaccuracies when I still need to look for my missing loved one? And I think that it just really puts into perspective how difficult this can be for the families.
Especially when information being shared is power for them who are actively looking for a loved one, and inaccuracies can do a deep disservice to that case and that person that's missing. What are other misconceptions that the public has about how stories of crime are produced and maybe even consumed?
I think one of them is just simply, it's only entertainment. Nobody's getting hurt. And I'm learning. When I consume this, I'm learning how to protect myself. So I'm telling myself that's why I'm consuming it. It's just a show. But the reality is, people do get hurt when it's inaccurate. The example you just gave of them talking about how your parents met being inaccurate, it may seem like such a small thing, but now it's out there and other productions about it are now going to say the same thing. And so it's like the telephone game. The story just continuously morphs over time to it becomes completely unrecognizable. So in that case, it's no longer just entertainment. It's definitely not true crime because it's no longer true. And people are getting hurt. It's not the right story. You're not learning the right things. You're not protecting yourself. You're feeding into this machine that is based on capitalism and sensationalism, and it is actually hurting people. These aren't actors. They're not celebrities. These aren't people that asked to be in this role. And it is very hurting.
I completely agree with that. Very similarly, I feel like one of the biggest misconceptions that I see is that consumers assume that the family members or the missing person's family agreed to the creation of the material that came out. People in my life are always shocked when I tell them that things come out without the family's consent, or in some cases, without them even knowing that it was coming out, so that they're completely blindsided. So very similar to Kelly, I think for me, that's one of the biggest misconceptions, is that this is harmless behavior when in reality, it can cause a lot of harm to these co-victims.
I think the way things are presented to us is deeply important. I always return in my brain to the fact that brands pay millions of dollars for a couple seconds of an ad in the Super Bowl. And if that doesn't prove the value of your attention and what's being displayed in front of your eyes and in your ear, I just don't know what does. The media has a deep impact in the way we consume stories, but that also means that what we are consuming and how it's made is super important as well. I'd love to get both of your perspectives on what you feel are the most harmful narratives that persist across true crime and traditional media in terms of survivorship or victimhood.
Earlier in my career, I focused a lot on missing persons coverage in mainstream news. And what I found was that specifically missing white women and girls received a lot more initial and repeated coverage than missing Black women and girls. And this refers to what Gwen Ifill termed as the missing white woman syndrome. And I think that this is a harmful pattern that has persisted for a long time and across multiple mediums. I personally believe that all missing people, regardless of their race or their gender or any other factor, deserve media attention. And they all have families and they all have communities that desperately want them home. And so for me, that is a harmful pattern that I've been tracking for many years in my own work. I think the more eyes looking for missing people, the better. So that's something that I've focused a lot of attention on. Within true crime, we see a lot of the same gender and race issues at play. And I do think this is getting better, but it is something that I've noticed is there is definitely a big focus on perpetrators and their motivations and their life stories. And I think that this is harmful for a lot of reasons, but especially for victims and their loved ones who are forced to engage with or watch these stories. And essentially, when it's so focused on the perpetrator, it's almost as if the victims become like a side story. I can't imagine how painful that is for those families. So for me, in the true crime space, one of the harmful narratives that I see is the over-glorification of perpetrators.
I completely agree with that. Danielle, I think you've used the word celebrification before, which is still one of my favorite words. By definition, a true crime narrative must be victim-centric. And so when it strays from that, and starts glorifying a perpetrator, it's no longer true crime by definition. But the average consumer doesn't know. They're not sitting in front of the TV with the dictionary in front of them saying, oh, well, this doesn't fit the definition of true crime. A lot of my work has focused on how domestic violence survivors are depicted in true crime, and specifically how domestic violence survivors in the audience consume true crime. And so one of the most damaging narratives that I continue to see is victim blaming. Why didn't she come forward? Why did they make that decision? How did she let this happen? Why was she out that late at night? Why was she wearing that? You see a lot of victim blaming. Specifically, in some narratives, you'll also see blaming of social standing, class, poverty, race, sexual orientation, gender identity. But even that young white blonde woman is still being victim blamed. She shouldn't have been out this late. She shouldn't have been wearing that. She shouldn't have had anything to drink. I still see that overwhelmingly.
There's no denying it. I do want to touch on what you said, Dr. Slakoff, about the kind of celebrification and or centering of a perpetrator. That is one thing that I have definitely noticed as a victim and a survivor. As a former English teacher, we were always taught to focus on theme and what is the message leaving these students with in the literature. And then suddenly as adults, we're not really thinking about the themes that we're leaving our listeners or our consumers. We're just making something salacious or centering on the crime or the gory details. In that, we're leaving people with the wrong information. We have an opportunity to educate. And by doing the opposite and centering the crime and amplifying the actions or the perpetrator, we have the unused opportunity to offer people resources, to offer people prevention, awareness, community.
I completely agree with everything you just said. And I think to your point from the criminology, victimology side, I think so many of these stories have an ability to teach people about domestic violence, for example, what the warning signs are and how important safety planning can be, how to keep yourself safe in certain situations. I don't want to paint a broad brush, but a lot of true crime is not focused on the education part as much, at least in my estimation. And that's something that I think it could go towards. I do understand people want to know the motivation. But when you focus so much on the perpetrator, there's often so much sensationalism, gore, things that are really not necessary to understanding that person's motivation. And so there should be some intentionality with what is making it into the final product. Does this need to be there? And what is the benefit of it being there?
Absolutely. And I do have to say, as someone who is reared with someone who has become the center of a lot of true crime productions and is one of those people that is a classic perpetrator, so exemplary in so many ways. The issue is that as a child, I actually watched him become really influenced by media too. He, months before murdering my mother, actually committed an attack on her that he had watched in the movie Serial Mom, which is a really dark comedy from the 90s. I highlight that because we aren't potentially influencing perpetrators if we keep a lot of those details that are harmful or potentially really darkly inspiring to other people that are potentially violent or already violent. We can't deny that watching what we watch and what we consume isn't impactful on us.
The one thing I would say is celebrification of perpetrators is not just completely unnecessary, but it's often the same perpetrators that get celebrified. How many more stories of Dahmer do we need to see? It's the same ones told over and over. So it's almost like they pick perpetrators and then intentionally celebrify them through multiple productions. That just compounds the trauma.
I completely agree. I was in a Vice News documentary about true crime. I talked a little bit about that specifically with Ted Bundy and the fact that he was getting fan mail and a ton of people reaching out to him while he was in prison, and he was very much celebrified. But what I was going to add on to that is, in talking with the co-victims, something that came out was that there are so many stories that still need attention, and yet some of the same stories get told over and over. That is also something that I think about a lot, is there are some families, especially from marginalized communities, victims of color, queer victims, that would really benefit from the media attention. And yet those are not the stories being told.
It's interesting because a lot of true crime is based on initial media coverage. So even the cases that have been closed and covered over and over again, like Dahmer, people who go into producing true crime on that are still going to look at the media coverage from those cases. Well, media coverage has been shown to be biased for decades. It almost always victim blames and regularly focuses on the missing white woman syndrome. Media coverage itself is biased. So if you start with that as your basis for true crime coverage, which a lot of true crime productions do, a lot of true crime podcasts do specifically, then your coverage is also going to be biased. You're also going to focus on the same cases that everybody else is focusing on, the same perpetrators that everybody else is focusing on. Right now, true crime has become such a capitalistic industry that you can get access to case files because they're in the public domain. And it's a very, for lack of a better word, easy way to produce this type of media. But all that does is perpetuate systemic stereotypes and systemic issues. Gabby Petito got a lot of coverage when she was missing. I'm not saying that she shouldn't have, but what I'm saying is she was a young white blonde woman who was heavily active on social media. She went missing in a national park in an area of the country where indigenous people have gone missing for decades, and they don't get that level of coverage. So the issue is they never got the traditional media coverage. So they're never going to get the true crime media coverage. It is a cycle of systemic issues that keeps getting perpetrated, I think, because of the ease of access to information in the public domain and the initial media coverage.
I get asked a lot about why are we seeing the same types of stories? And I think that part of it is that these stories are very profitable. And I know that makes people uncomfortable to talk about, but that is something that I have talked about extensively in the years since I wrote my work. These stories, consumers are sharing them with their friends and family and putting them on their social media pages, and all of those clicks and shares, they translate into advertising revenue for these media companies. Of course, there's a chicken or egg situation here, but I think part of what's happening is that these stories are doing well. So content creators and media companies are like, well, this story did well, so let's do our own version of the same story because it continues to do well. And so I completely agree with Kelly that it almost becomes this cycle where when something gets attention at the beginning, it just continues and continues and continues. And I really do think a big part of that is what they view as profitability. It's so tragic because essentially that means that certain stories aren't viewed to be as profitable. I do think that consumers should be very intentional about what they are sharing and watching, and recognizing that with those clicks and shares, they are essentially telling these companies what they want to see more of. So I tell consumers, it would be helpful for companies to know we do have an interest in diverse stories, but they're not going to see that if the only things being watched are the same types of documentaries, for example.
That's such an interesting point because I've gotten that question several times at different stages when I've tried to share our story is, what was the initial coverage like, or who covered it first? That always struck me. I'm like, nobody. That's why I'm asking for the coverage. It's such an interesting point that you make. Knowing that is powerful. How can creators avoid reinforcing biases when choosing which stories to spotlight and how to frame them?
It's the same, honestly, as within a lot of media decisions. It has to be intentional. If they intentionally cover marginalized stories or stories that didn't get heavy media coverage initially, or they try to correct narratives that were wrong, their job's harder. They have to dig harder into the court documents. They have to interview more people. It's a harder road, but the only way to do that is to be intentional. And that is with any media. If you're going to make any kind of movie, You need to be intentional about who you cast in that movie and what the storyline is. The only way to include diverse voices and to make sure that marginalized stories are covered is for the people sitting around the producer table to do it with intention.
I completely agree with that. I'll even say this is something else that is so hard to talk about is if we're talking about the mainstream media, we still see a lack of diversity in a lot of newsrooms. And the higher up you go, meaning the more and more powerful in the newsroom, we see less and less diversity. This is tricky to talk about because, yes, I do think that more diverse newsrooms would be helpful to telling more diverse stories. But I also feel like that is a ton of pressure to put on journalists of color, for example, or queer journalists. That's a lot of pressure to put on them to say, hey, we're going to put you in this organization and you need to be the champion of these stories. So I completely agree with Kelly. There has to be buy-in and intention, and it needs to start at the top.
That's such a good point both of you have made. Thank you. What would you say meaningful and trauma-informed content looks like?
I think first and foremost, the content has got to be victim-centric. You also don't produce anything without the consent of everyone that is depicted and involved. So if you're going to reenact a court scene, then everybody in that court scene needs to know that's happening and sign off on it. Nobody should be surprised by what they see on TV. One of the things we also heard from our participants is they get no control over the final edit or narrative or any say. Well, that's an easy way to fix the inaccuracies. So even if victims and co-victims and survivors agree to produce this or to be in the production, they should still have a significant say in the final cut to make sure that it is accurate and that it is telling the correct story and that it's not getting too sensationalized. They need to be involved throughout the entire process. And I get that's more expensive, that takes longer, and it may not be as profitable in the end because of the product that's produced. But it's ethical. It would be meant to help and not hurt. So making something victim-centric, designing it to be victim-centric, keeping them involved throughout the entire process is critical.
I completely agree. I feel like getting consent from these families is so important. Letting the families know ahead of time what is the goal of what's being created and what is the angle being taken, because again, some people were so caught off guard by how the piece ended up being and what the angle ended up being. Asking families if they'd like to participate, but taking no for an answer is really important. I also think that giving them the opportunity to see or hear the product before it's released, for the exact same reasons that Kelly just said, it can help fix inaccuracies. It can build trust with the creator. And yes, it will definitely take longer. You may have to re-edit something. You may have to reorient part of the story, but I agree that that is so important for the families. And then in terms of the trauma-informed side, I think it would be great for family members or loved ones to have, for example, a mental health support person or an advocate on set with them, just to have somebody to debrief with. I will tell you that even on the research side, we get taught about debriefing and making sure we're taking care of ourselves after interviews. And so the same should go for anybody who's part of this, is they should have a safe place to be able to debrief these interviews. There are just so many families that do want the attention on their loved ones' cases. And so I think creators should be a lot more intentional about seeking out those people. And I go back to this a lot. Just because a story can be told doesn't mean that it should be told.
Absolutely. It makes me beg the question, how can a consumer look at a true crime production, podcast, film, show, anything, and know if it is a more ethical or trauma-informed production?
It's a hard one to be able to say, how would a consumer know? I think the bigger question there is, how do we get to a point where consumers want to know that what they're consuming is ethical and that it's helping those who were harmed? How do we get to a point where consumers don't want to consume sensationalized stuff? How can we educate consumers to a point that they are actually driving good out of the genre based on what they consume. So wherever the advertising dollars go, wherever the sponsorship dollars go, that's where the eyes and the ears are. So if we can get the consumers to actually want to consume the good stuff and turn away from the bad will lose its funding. So instead of trying to regulate the industry, it feels like it might be easier to draw interest from the consumers so that they care about ethical production.
I agree. And I would say this is obviously not foolproof by any means, but a lot of times I will literally Google search what I'm about to consume just to see. There was this movie on Netflix. I'm like, oh, this looks good. Googled it. And the very first thing that popped up was that the child victim in this case, the parents were very upset that it was made and wish it hadn't been made. And so I know that's very overly simplistic, but in that quick Google search, I was able to see, oh, this is not something that aligns with what I want to watch. Again, that's putting a lot of pressure on the consumer to do that work. But I do think, to Kelly's point, that we should be thinking more about the consumer side and trying to get that info to them. I'm in an optimistic mood today. I really think that consumers do care. And I think that when faced with, this was created without family consent, this is re-traumatizing and re-triggering to them, I do think that consumers would care about that. But right now, they're not getting that information. I think that we have to figure out a way to get that information to them. True crime has become something to chat about with friends. And we see this a lot on the social media pages and on Reddit. In our second paper, where we talked about the problems with true crime or the negatives, we have a whole section on fandom and how there is a fandom to true crime that is not dissimilar to other popular fandoms. We talk a little bit about like sports teams and Swifties, right? These very popular fandoms. I feel like somehow getting through to this group about the ethical issues would be really, really important in making changes. And I'm hoping that some of those people would also be invested in changing it for the better.
I was just sitting here nodding my head in agreement. I think a lot of the change needs to be audience driven. The media industry right now is spiraling. And I don't know that the media industry is going to have the financial incentives to be more ethical. But if it is audience driven, I think that is a big portion of it. But I also worry, too, that we didn't talk enough about the good side of it. That's important, too, from a consumer perspective, to see that consumers have the ability to drive what the media covers. They can set the media's agenda. And so showing them that they have that power and how they can leverage the media for good in cases that need that coverage would be a huge positive to the industry.
I think conversations like this are so important because it's got to be the consumers, it's got to be the creators, the families, the interviewees, all of them. We all have to come to some sort of agreement that we want it to be better. I do feel hopeful that change can come. But a big part of that is teaching people about what we learned here, about the fact that there are positives, but there are also negatives. And how can we better the field to keep those positives rolling, but also trying to make it so that it's safer for the people involved? I feel really grateful that I get to do this work with people like Dr. Bowling, who feel like I do, that this work is really important and it's not niche. And there are so many people that are being impacted by this. I leave this conversation with both of you just feeling really grateful that there are people that want to talk about this and make a change.
Well, I'm so grateful for both of you. In a 18-year span of my life where I felt largely unheard and fought for a lot of media representation just to be able to hopefully make change by sharing is really huge for us. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Amy, for giving us this opportunity to talk more in depth about the research.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.